American Free Press Audio Edition Issues Number 33 and 34 August 12 and 19, 2019. Free Speech Triumph Judge Rules Man Fired for Beliefs Had Rights Violated, by John Friend, a former Memphis Light, Gas and Water Division, MLGW, employee. Won an important lawsuit earlier this summer when U.S. District Judge John McCalla ruled the man had his constitutionally protected rights to free speech and equal protection under the law violated when he was forced out of his job as a result of holding politically incorrect political views. Michael Goza, who had worked as a customer service field technician for the local Memphis Public Utility, filed a lawsuit against his former employer in December 2017 after initially being suspended by MLGW for statements he made on Facebook and participating in a rally protesting the removal of Confederate memorials in downtown Memphis earlier that summer. While attending the rally, Goza spoke to local media outlets explaining his reasoning for participating, and was later identified by members of the public as an MLGW employee. The public utility then suspended Goza while an investigation was launched, and he was subsequently offered an ultimatum: assume a new role with the public utility that offered less pay and no field contact with African American customers of the public utility, or be fired from his job. Goza refused the utility's offer and was immediately fired. In his lawsuit, Goza argued that his First Amendment rights to free speech were violated by the public utility, and that his termination was retaliatory in nature. Black employees of the utility engaged in similar constitutionally protected expressions of free speech, yet they were not punished or terminated from their jobs, according to Goza. According to local reports, a black employee of MLGW had previously advocated on social media killing Asian Americans, which eventually came to the attention of the public utility. The black employee was merely suspended for 3 days rather than being demoted or potentially terminated, as was the case with Goza. The judge ruled in Goza's favor, agreeing with his arguments that he was treated unfairly by the public utility and that his First Amendment rights were violated. The government does not have to turn a blind eye to the speech of its employees, but MLGW's decisions in this case were based on unconstitutional factors, Judge McCalla argued in his ruling decision, which was handed down earlier this summer. The judge also noted that Goza's participation in a pro-Confederate monument rally was done as a private citizen rather than as a public employee, noting that Goza was speaking as a private citizen and on matters of public concern. While attending the rally, Goza spoke to the Commercial Appeal, a local Memphis news outlet. "What I'm tired of is being portrayed as KKK or a white supremacist simply because I'm a white guy who wants to preserve my heritage," Goza said at the time. According to the lawsuit, some of Goza's statements may have been insensitive, offensive, and even bigoted, but they were protected by the Constitution nonetheless. Judge McCalla wrote, "MLGW thus violated Goza's First Amendment rights when it demoted and fired him." According to the Daily Memphian, MLGW must pay Goza roughly $160,000 in back pay and benefits, and an additional $30,000 in compensatory damages. "The public utility must also rehire Goza. We're really happy with the result," Bryce Ashby, one of Goza's lawyers, stated shortly after the ruling was released. "We put MLGW on notice early on that we thought this was a First Amendment violation, and we're pleased that the court saw it our way." Goza's successful case is a breath of fresh air to millions of Americans across the country concerned about the stifling impact of political correctness and extreme anti-white bigotry that is so prevalent in society today. Far left won't leave any tragedy unexploited. In the March 25th and April 1st edition of American Free Press, we published a personal from the editor on page 2 with the headline, "Conservatives Not Responsible for Mosque Massacre." At that time, conservatives were being attacked with charges that they had incited a lunatic shooter with their calls for strict immigration controls, among other things. Back then, we argued that the terrible incident was being distorted and shamelessly exploited just to suit the agenda of the radical left. Here we are again, 5 months later, with two back-to-back shootings in Texas and Ohio, and the big media and left-wing agitators have wasted no time misrepresenting what exactly happened just so they can again try to pin blame on conservatives, gun owners, and, of course, President Trump. Well, guess what? They were wrong then, and they're wrong now. Back in March, we took aim at these agitators, editorializing, "This terrible incident should have been reported as a horrible tragedy carried out by a violent, crazy person," but that's not what's been happening. Instead, the mainstream media and far left-wing activists have been cynically misrepresenting what happened to point an accusatory finger at conservatives, critics of immigration, President Donald Trump, and, of course, white people in general, all because the lunatic shooter was a white male. While most of the major media as well as liberals and Democrat elites have been twisting the shootings in Dayton and El Paso to suit their agenda, the reality is very far from what most Americans are reading. Clearly, these two young men were mentally unstable, but what is worth noting is that, if one objectively looks at their lives and their beliefs, they were heavily influenced by the doomsday rhetoric invoked by both the left and the right. As columnist Pat Buchanan says in his piece on page 30, "The El Paso shooter, in a manifesto that he purportedly published on the internet right before he carried out his attack, states unequivocally that environmental catastrophe brought about by climate change was a key motivator prompting him to take action. He also wrote about automation of jobs, the looming crisis for American workers, and the need for a universal basic income to counter the coming job apocalypse." The crazed murderer ranted about these issues for much of his screed. To be honest, had he not committed mass murder, he sounds like he would fit right in with Democrat presidential contenders at their political rallies. It was largely because of these two looming crises that this young man felt hopeless and believed he needed to personally commit violence against immigrants in this country to force a reaction on the part of U.S. and Central American governments. Something that the big media and liberals have left out when trying to pin the blame for this heinous act squarely on President Trump. And then there was the shooter in Ohio, who unequivocally voiced support for Sens, Bernie Sanders, IVT, and Elizabeth Warren, DeMass. He was also a proud atheist and socialist and attacked the U.S. capitalist society in many of his online writings. While these two gunmen seem, at face value, to have been interested in different subjects, one thread that did tie them together was an apparent reaction to heated rhetoric claiming Americans' way of life is rapidly coming to a close. But is this really happening? Lost in all of this back and forth about environmental catastrophe, racism, sexism, poverty, violence, and costly healthcare is the fact that Americans, today, are living in the safest society ever developed in the history of mankind. In the United States, violence is at historic lows. Every year, out of a population of more than 350 million, 600,000 Americans die from heart disease while fewer than 20,000 die from violence of any sort. And, while liberals claim America is racist, hundreds of millions of taxpayers' dollars are given out in the form of scholarships so that minorities and poor people can get an education. In fact, we are living in such good times that, according to studies, the average poor person in the U.S. owns at least one car, has cable television service, a video game system, and air conditioning. Even the poorest American has access to health care that the richest elites didn't have just 50 years ago. Finally, unlike in many countries today, there is so much food in the U.S. that there's actually an obesity epidemic among the poor. This is not to say that the current situation couldn't spiral out of control and turn dire in this country should Americans continue down a dark path, but it is worth pausing a moment to take a breath and celebrate just how great this country really is. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor, "Super Rich Pedophile Nearly Suicided in Jail, Chelsea Clinton Now Linked to Jeff Epstein's Madam," by S.T. Patrick on July 26. Accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein was found in his Manhattan jail cell injured with marks on his neck. Epstein said he was beaten up, but officials refused to say whether he was assaulted or the injury was self-inflicted. He had been on suicide watch, but observers interested in the secrets Epstein may hold have been worried that he may be suicided before any potential for outing the elite and powerful has been realized. Epstein had been denied bail by Judge Richard Berman and has been housed at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York City. Berman turned down Epstein's request for a $100 million bail package that would have allowed him to live in his Upper East Side Manhattan mansion because his alleged excessive attraction to sexual conduct with or in the presence of minor girls, which is said to include his soliciting and receiving massages from young girls and young women perhaps as many as four times a day, appears likely to be uncontrollable. While the gut emotional instinct of many Americans has been to cheer Epstein's denial of bail, the longer Epstein remains within the walls of a general population jail or prison, the less likely the chances are that any of his elite co-conspirators will be exposed. While Epstein is in direct danger, so is the truth behind his story. Conservative columnist Ann Coulter has pleaded on Twitter that Epstein be immediately moved to a supermax facility so that the people who want him dead won't be able to hide their complicity in his sex trafficking crimes. Though Bill Clinton's family has been intimately tied to Epstein, his Boeing 727, called Lolita Express, and his island, called Pedophile Island, the former president has denied any wrongdoing or knowledge of wrongdoing. Longtime critics of the Clinton political machine, however, want Epstein to remain safe long enough to expose the truth of that friendship, that is, before he becomes another victim of the much-publicized Clinton body count. The amazingly high number of suicides that have occurred to people exposing Clintonian misdeeds. But now the Clintons have a new public relations problem directly connected with Epstein's circle, and it isn't Bill. In a July 21 story for the Politico News website, Ben Schreckinger and Daniel Lipman tied Chelsea Clinton to Epstein Madam Ghislaine Maxwell and said that the two continued to socialize even after Epstein had been previously jailed on sex offenses. According to Politico, Maxwell became close with the Clinton family after they had left the White House. She vacationed with Chelsea, now the vice chair of the Clinton Foundation, on a yacht in 2009. She attended Chelsea's wedding to Mark Mezvinsky in 2010, and she was a participant in the Clinton Global Initiative in 2013. These events all took place after Epstein had already struck the first plea deal and Maxwell had publicly been tied to his operation as his procurer-in-chief. Someone familiar with the Clinton-Maxwell relationship told Schreckinger and Lipman, Maxwell ended up being close to the Clinton family because she and Chelsea ended up being close. A spokesperson for Chelsea Clinton and Mezvinsky said that the couple were not aware of Maxwell's ties to Epstein or his operation when they socialized for at least 5 years from 2009 to 2013. Chelsea Clinton's chief of staff Barry Lurie told Politico, it wasn't until 2015 that Chelsea and Mark became aware of the horrific allegations against Ghislaine Maxwell and hope that all the victims find justice. In Hillary and Bill, the sex volume, the late Victor Thorne linked Ghislaine Maxwell to Bill Clinton. The first of Thorne's three-volume Hillary and Bill series was released in 2008, the year Epstein received the sweetheart deal from Alex Acosta, when he was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida. Thorne was citing rumors of a Clinton-Maxwell relationship that had dated back to the 1990s. He simply referred to Maxwell as Ghislaine Maxwell, daughter of the late British press lord Robert Maxwell. Like Epstein, Bill Clinton has also been a member of the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations. So, despite the reactionary emotional hostilities that surround pedophilia and despite the ease of gambling on one's righteous indignation, Epstein needs to stay alive and unharmed, even if someone else knows what Epstein knows. An Epstein suicide would surely scare them into permanent silence. For Epstein to talk, if he will ever talk, the case must come to fruition and his silence must not be a part of any agreement. Corruption Queen's immunity deals. Clinton cronies James Comey, Loretta Lynch made sure Hillary avoided prosecution. By Donald Jeffries. Documents recently obtained by the American Center for Law and Justice, ACLJ, detailed the immunity agreements between the U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, and attorneys for Hillary Clinton. According to the ACLJ, these agreements revealed that Clinton's lawyers had been allowed to dispose of evidence and refused to comply with federal law. The attorneys in question, Cheryl Mills and Heather Samuelson, were granted immunity from felony prosecution for anything discovered on their laptops. The head of ACLJ is one of Donald Trump's personal lawyers, Jay Sekulow. The organization issued a public statement that reads, "The ACLJ has just obtained previously unreleased documents related to the Clinton investigation and immunity agreements given to top Clinton aides. These agreements reveal that James Comey's Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, and Loretta Lynch's Department of Justice granted immunity to Clinton's aides and lawyers, Cheryl Mills and Heather Samuelson, from prosecution for anything found on their laptops violating multiple felony criminal statutes governing the mishandling of classified information and the removal or destruction of records, including Espionage Act provisions." Further, the DOJ and FBI also agreed to evade the statutory requirements of the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, by purporting to deem the contents of the laptops as not under DOJ or FBI custody or control. Both Comey's FBI and Lynch's DOJ consistently shielded former Secretary of State Clinton and her legal representatives from criminal liability, as well as public scrutiny, by blocking the release of potentially incriminating emails from FOIA requests. The ACLJ went on to state, "These laptops were critical to any meaningful investigation of Hillary Clinton's handling of classified emails and records." According to the DOJ Inspector General, who identified these as the Culling laptops, LL62320 emails pulled from the Clinton servers were stored at one time on these laptops, having taken control of these laptops, agreeing to severely limited searches, agreeing to unlawfully shield the laptops from FOIA, then agreeing to dispose of the laptops. It appears the Comey FBI and Lynch DOJ did everything in their power to protect Clinton's senior aides and lawyers from both criminal liability and public scrutiny. The FBI and the DOJ helpfully offered to dispose of the laptops used by Mills and Samuelson, where the emails from Clinton's servers were known to be stored. The FBI had previously disclosed the disquieting fact that a former aide to Bill Clinton had destroyed the former First Lady's mobile devices using a hammer. FBI documents released in late 2016 revealed that the aide in question, Justin Cooper, recalled two instances where he destroyed Clinton's old mobile phones by breaking them in half or hitting them with a hammer. Clinton, who was notorious for switching mobile devices with a frequency that frustrated those around her, memorably said that she didn't know that C markings in an email chain designated classified or confidential information. She actually claimed she thought it meant the paragraphs were being marked in alphabetical order. Predictably, Clinton had tried to shift responsibility onto her aides. Clinton did not recall receiving any email she thought should not be on an unclassified system. The FBI's report on Clinton's interview noted, she relied on state officials to use their judgment when emailing her and could not recall anyone raising concerns with her regarding the sensitivity of the information she received at her email address. It was also reported that her ex-Secretary of State Peer Colin Powell had warned her that if such emails while in office ever became public, they would become official record, s, and subject to the law. Powell advised her, "Be very careful. I got around it all by not saying much and not using systems that captured the data," the report stated. Regarding the server found conspicuously on her property, that Clinton had no knowledge of the reasons for selecting it to install it in the basement of her Chappaqua, NY home. She also denied using the server to evade the Federal Records Act, as well as having any conversations about using the server to avoid FOIA. Continuing her litany of denials, Clinton stated that she did not remember a State Department email that was sent in late June 2011, which lectured employees about the importance of securing their personal email accounts to correspond with the upgrading of her ClintonEmail.com server. She even tried to attribute some of her faulty memory to a December 2012 concussion, explaining that she could not recall every briefing she received. The report noted that Clinton was unaware of the requirement to turn over printed records at that time. Her physical records were boxed up and handled by aides. Clinton has earned the title Queen of Corruption for good reason. Supreme Court clears way for border wall to proceed, by Dave Gallery, in a major victory for President Donald J. Trump late last month. The U.S. Supreme Court, SCOTUS, gave him what he wanted, money to build his anti-legal alien border wall on the southern fringes of America, although not exactly what Trump had promised during his U.S. presidential announcement in June 2015, "I will build a great, great wall on our southern border and I'll have Mexico pay for that wall." The decision by SCOTUS releases funds to help secure the porous partition that separates the U.S. and Mexico. In effect, SCOTUS is allowing the president to use funds earmarked for the Pentagon on what's come to be simply referred to as the wall, breathing life into four major previously awarded contracts that were in limbo while tied up in the courts. The wall funding imbroglio began when Trump used his presidential powers to declare a national emergency along the border, after a sharply divided U.S. Congress refused to allocate enough money for the wall, according to a July 26 article on NPR.com entitled "Supreme Court Lets Trump Border Wall Move Forward, But Legal Fight Still Looms." A lower court had initially frozen the $2.5 billion in funds, and an appeals court had agreed, but the administration then asked the Supreme Court to review the freeze, and in a 5-4 decision the High Court granted the stay late Friday evening. The 5-4 decision also highlights Trump's successful strategy of placing conservatives on the High Court, Neil Gorsuch in 2017 and Brett Kavanaugh in 2018, as justices split along ideological lines, with the four more liberal justices dissenting. Trump's main nemesis in his latest battle in trying to make America great again is the liberal, culture-destroying American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, which convinced a federal judge to rule against the president. U.S. District Judge Haywood Gilliam declared Trump's plans unlawful, writing that the executive branch's plans to reappropriate funds denied by the legislative branch does not score with fundamental separation of powers principles dating back to the earliest days of our republic, and while SCOTUS disagreed, the ACLU is determined to fight and is attempting to get an expedited hearing before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit over the legality of Trump's actions. "This is not over," promised pro-mass immigration ACLU staff attorney Dror Ladin. "We will be asking the federal appeals court to expedite the ongoing appeals proceeding to halt the irreversible and imminent damage from Trump's border wall, border communities, the environment, and our Constitution's separation of powers will be permanently harmed should Trump get away with pillaging military funds for a xenophobic border wall Congress denied." Someone needs to tell Ladin that keeping one's borders secure from illegal incursions is not xenophobia but sane policy meant to ensure the survival of this nation. Attorney General Keeping Barbarians Outside Gates, by Dave Gahery. While a do-nothing U.S. Congress and activist judges refused to staunch the flow of illegal immigrants from breaching our southern border, U.S. Attorney General William Barr has a few tricks up his sleeve to fulfill President Donald J. Trump's campaign promise to reduce the flow of illegal aliens into the United States. A ruling from the Attorney General late last month closes a door almost asylum seekers who fear persecution to add to family ties, reported NBC News on July 31. The process, known as certification, utilized by his predecessor Jeff Sessions, limits the number of migrants fearing persecution to add to family ties from seeking asylum here, overturning years of precedent. Barr reversed a finding from the Board of Immigration Appeals, BIA, which ruled that a Mexican man and his family, who claimed to be threatened by gangs when his father refused to let them use his store, made up a social group. As NBC reported, U.S. law requires asylum seekers to prove they fear persecution based on race, religion, nationality, political opinion or membership in a particular social group. The Attorney General, using his unique powers, didn't buy that, and ruled that a family does not qualify as such a group just because it is being persecuted, drastically lowering the number of asylum seekers with a stroke of a pen. No wall needed. The BIA, part of the U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, and the highest administrative body for interpreting and applying immigration laws, with as many as 21 board members, decides appeals by reviewing cases, only rarely hearing oral arguments in a courtroom setting. Since immigration courts are controlled by the DOJ, unlike most federal courts, which are part of the judiciary, the Attorney General is both the nation's top prosecutor and, in the case of immigration courts, its top judge, And unlike some attorneys general, Barr is unafraid to use these powers. While Bill Clinton was president, there were only three such rulings, 16 under George W. Bush, and 4 under Barack Obama. President Trump's dodge, however, is on pace to outstrip any prior administration in rendering these rulings. Sessions was no stranger to certification, either, using the procedure to rule that most immigrants fleeing gang and domestic violence could not qualify for asylum, reversing an over 40-year precedent. He also eliminated the ability of judges to administratively close cases, a tool they had often used to move dockets along more quickly. Barr followed in Sessions's footsteps, ruling in June to limit a detainee's ability to bond out of detention. With a backlog approaching an incredible 1 million cases that need to be heard by immigration judges, desperate times call for desperate measures, and Bill Barr seems to be exactly what we need to restore some sanity to this broken system. Hersh Tape details FBI report on murdered DNC employee. By S.T. Patrick, the newly released audio and transcript of a 2016 phone call between Texas money manager Ed Butowski and investigative journalist Seymour Hersh appears to cast more suspicion on the Rashiagut narrative that, though long disproven, just won't die. The Hersh-Butowski call also brings back the story of Seth Rich's yet unsolved murder, a story which author Michael Isakoff has tried to bury on his new six-part podcast for Yahoo News, Conspiracy Land. Isakoff has said that the point of his podcast is to debunk the conspiracy theory that Rich might have been murdered because he gave the DNC and Podesta emails to WikiLeaks. Isakoff's own conspiracy theory is that Russians created and then spread the theory that Rich was murdered because he, via WikiLeaks, exposed the Democratic Party's stratagem against Senator Bernie Sanders's candidacy in 2016. Hersh and Butowski agreed that they were speaking in confidence. Butowski recorded the conversation. He said, because his handwriting is so poor that he couldn't take legible notes. When Butowski later believed Hersh had betrayed his confidence, he released the audio to YouTube and the Reddit social media site. The conversation revolved around information gathered from two sources, a high-level FBI source who had seen a report on Rich's death and his involvement with WikiLeaks for Hersh, and a well-connected woman associated with Butowski. Hersh's high-level FBI source revealed that the Bureau's own internal report documented that in late spring 2016 Rich made contact with WikiLeaks. Rich submitted a sampling of emails from the DNC and requested money for the rest. Rich had a protected online Dropbox file storage account for which WikiLeaks later acquired the password. Before Rich was killed, Rich shared the information about dealing with WikiLeaks with a couple of friends and said, "If anything happens to me, this is not going to solve your problem." Rich's message to friends seems cryptic, and Hersh stated in the call that he's unsure as to what that really meant. The main point that Hersh makes is that the files given to WikiLeaks from Rich are what are now known as the Podesta DNC emails. Rich was the source of those emails, not the Russians. When asked by Hersh what he knows, Butowski discusses a friend of his who had met with Assange earlier in the year. Assange told Butowski's friend, whom he described as a personal friend of Assange, that it was Rich who was the source of the Podesta DNC email leaks. "Whoa," Hersh then exclaimed, as he had never heard it stated directly from Assange himself. The WikiLeaks founder had strongly hinted at least twice that the source was Rich, but this was the most direct quote ever attributed to Assange on the sourcing of the emails. Hersh had been working on the story since August 2016 because he foresaw that Russia would be blamed and used as the scapegoat in the story. Hersh's high-level FBI source, who he has used to read internal FBI reports on multiple occasions, confirmed that Russia was not the source of the email leaks to WikiLeaks. One of the more interesting segments of the call occurred when Hersh gave Butowski his own theory of how the Rashiagut story all began. "I'm going to tell you something," Hersh told Butowski, "and you're just going to have to trust me. I have what they call in my business long-form journalism. I have a narrative of how that whole thing began. It's a former CIA director John Brennan operation. It was American disinformation and going after the president. One thing proved truer than any Rashiagut theory. Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's recent visit to Capitol Hill answered nothing and produced no legitimate defense of his report. On July 20, the New York Times observed, "For 2 years, Democrats have waited on Robert Mueller to deliver a death blow to the Trump presidency. That moment never came." Aaron Mattei of the left-leaning magazine The Nation summarized what Mueller's failed congressional appearance really meant. "The very fact that Democrats had to subpoena Mueller in order to create this final moment should in fact be the final reminder of what a mistake it was for Democrats to have waited on him," Mattei wrote. "If Mueller had incriminating information yet to share, or had been stymied from doing his work, or if Attorney General William Barr had somehow misrepresented his findings, then it stands to reason that Mueller would be welcoming the opportunity to appear before Congress, not resisting it. The reality is that Mueller's investigation did not indict anyone on the Trump campaign for collusion with Russia, or even for anything related to the 2016 election. Mueller's report found no evidence of a Trump-Russia conspiracy, and even undermined the case for it. The real conspiracy land now rests in the shattered remains of Rachel Maddow's spiraling ratings. The Russians killed Seth Rich. The Russians started the Seth Rich as leaker rumors. We are in the midst of a new Red Scare with frothing never-Trumpers seeing red in the eyeballs of every perceived enemy. Let's hope it doesn't take decades once again to realize the national disgraces that stem from delusional fear. Spending surges national suicide. Time to kick the habit and stop throwing billions down the drain on militarism." By Dr. Ron Paul. With a national debt approaching $23 trillion and a $1 trillion deficit for this year alone, Congress decided to double down on suicidal spending, passing a 12-year budget that has the United States careening toward catastrophe. "While we cannot say precisely when the economic crash will occur, we do know that it is coming, and in late July Congress pounded down on the accelerator. We are told that the U.S. economy is experiencing unprecedented growth, while at the same time the Federal Reserve is behaving as it does when we are in recession by cutting rates and dodging insults from the president because it's not cutting fast enough. This is not economic policy, it's schizophrenia, but that's only the beginning. Take what they call national defense spending. This is the misnomer they use to try and convince us that pumping trillions into the military-industrial complex will make us safe and free. Nothing could be further from the truth. Probably 90% of the defense budget is aggressive militarism and welfare for the rich. Under this budget deal, the military budget would increase to nearly $1.4 trillion for 2 years. Of course, that's only a fraction of real military spending, which is, all told, well over $1 trillion per year. What do we get for this money? Are we safer? Not at all. We are more vulnerable than ever. We spend billions fighting terrorism in Africa while terrorism has actually increased since the creation of the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, in 2007. Meanwhile, we continue to spend to maintain our illegal military occupation of a large section of Syria, which benefits terrorist groups seeking to overthrow Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. We're sending thousands more troops to the Middle East, including basing U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia for the first time since 2003. Back then, even neocon Paul Wolfowitz praised our departure from Saudi Arabia because, as he rightly stated, U.S. troops on Saudi soil was a great recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. "Now we've pulled out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, INF, treaty so that we can deploy once forbidden missiles on China's front door. A new arms race with China will mean a new boon for our new defense secretary's former colleagues at Raytheon." Senator Rand Paul, RCI, pronounced the Tea Party dead with the adoption of this budget. He's right, of course, but only when it comes to Congress. "Given the opportunity, I still believe a good part of the American people will vote for candidates who promise to rein in the national credit card." President Donald Trump himself ran on a platform of ending deficit spending and even paying off the national debt. So the Tea Party may be dead in Washington, but I am not convinced it was ever really alive in Washington. With a few exceptions, most politicians saw the Tea Party as just the flavor of the month. Spending is what keeps Washington alive and keeps the D.C. suburbs rich. They're not about to cut back on their own, but the spending will end. The trillions thrown down the drain on militarism will end. The only question is whether it will end when we are completely bankrupt and at the mercy of countries we've kicked around for decades, or whether Americans will demand an end to bipartisan addiction to war and spending in Washington. Smeared teenager loses in court, Catholic boy the victim of judge's politically motivated decision. Will appeal, by Donald Jeffries. William Bertelsmann, an elderly federal judge in Kentucky, nominated to the bench by President Jimmy Carter, dismissed beleaguered Catholic teenager Nicholas Sandman's $250 million lawsuit against the Washington Post in late July. Incredibly, the judge ruled that the Post's First Amendment rights allowed it to publish the opinion of Native American elder Nathan Phillips, whose fanciful account of the incident outside Washington, D.C.'s Lincoln Memorial earlier this year helped portray Sandman and his fellow students as entitled, disrespectful beneficiaries of white privilege. The fact that the full video of the incident revealed Phillips to have completely distorted the events, and that it exposed the real instigators as a group of vile, racist black Hebrew Israelites, evidently held no importance to Bertelsmann. The court accepted Sandman's statement that, when he was standing motionless in the confrontation with Phillips, his intent was to calm the situation and not to impede or block anyone, Bertelsmann wrote in his opinion. However, Phillips did not see it that way. He concluded that he was being blocked and not allowed to retreat. He passed these conclusions on to the Post. They may have been erroneous, but they are opinion protected by the First Amendment, and the Post is not liable for publishing these opinions, for the reasons discussed in this opinion. So, in the words of this powerful judge, accuracy is of no significance in news reporting, even if inaccurate reporting results in reputations being damaged. Bertelsmann is clearly not averse to individuals suing media outlets over unfair reporting. In 2009, NFL cheerleader Sarah Jones filed suit against the website Thedirty.com, claiming that it had published malicious gossip depicting her as promiscuous and alleging that she'd even transmitted venereal diseases to others. The website owners, like the Post, moved to dismiss the case, arguing reasonably that it had immunity from material authored by third party, often anonymous sources. In this case, Bertelsmann didn't dismiss, but allowed the suit to go forward. An interesting comparison arises here. The same judge who ruled an NFL cheerleader had possibly been defamed by anonymous posters on an internet site dismissed a lawsuit from an underage high school student who had been openly mocked, threatened, and clearly cast into a bad guy role that wasn't in line with the facts. The difference, of course, is that the defendant in Sandman's first suit was one of the most powerful organs in the state-controlled mainstream media. In Sandman's case, triggered members of the public attempted to contact his prospective colleges and demand they not accept his application, and there were countless violent memes all over social media, laughingly suggesting he be punched in the face. Meanwhile, there was no such saturation coverage of Elder Phillips when it was discovered that he hadn't served in Vietnam, as he claimed repeatedly in early interviews, that he had a violent criminal record, and that he possessed an obvious anti-Catholic bias. As only a short time before the incident with the Covington teens, he had attempted to lead protesters into disrupting mass at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C. Lost in all the defamatory, misleading news coverage of the event was the fact that Sandman and his classmates were on a simple field trip to attend a March for Life event in the nation's capital. As a result of the heavy, biased coverage, even their own faculty at Covington High School, as well as the Catholic Diocese of Covington, originally blamed and condemned the students. Sandman's attorneys had initially asked for an apology and retraction from the Post and other outlets like CNN and CBS, against whom lawsuits remain to be heard. The Post hardly sounded contrite when it published a statement reading, in part, subsequent reporting, a student's statement, an additional video allow for a more complete assessment of what occurred, either contradicting or failing to confirm accounts provided in that January 18th story. There would be no apology or retraction. This author exchanged emails with one of Sandman's attorneys last week, asked for his impressions of this rather surprising opinion. Todd McMurtry replied, "Yes, it was disappointing to lose the initial case. We all think the court's opinion is flawed and that we have a strong shot to turn this around on appeal. We will see. Another of Sandman's attorneys, Lynn Wood, reacted to the outrageous decision in a tweet, "If you wonder how and why our public discourse has deteriorated to its present level, look no further than the order issued in Nicholas's defamation case against WAPO protecting negligent publication of false and vicious accusations against a minor child. The order must be reversed. Israel lobby keeps on winning. Russian meddling in U.S. elections pales in comparison to Israeli interference." By Philip Giraldi. Some years ago, American politician Pat Buchanan described Congress as Israeli-occupied territory. As a result, he was viciously attacked by the mainstream media and the political leadership of both parties, demonstrating beyond all doubt that he was correct in his observation. Today, the Israel lobby in the United States is far more powerful than it was in 1990, so much so that Israel's prime minister actually boasts to his voters that he directs U.S. policy. The hypocrisy inherent in the Israel-philia of America's political leadership is such that it sometimes produces comic results. The whiny head of the House Intelligence Committee, Rep. Adam Schiff, D.Califf, was beside himself prior to the Robert Mueller testimony before Congress on July 24, denouncing Russia and President Donald Trump. He said that the president's actions amounted to disloyalty to country. Those are strong words. But disloyalty to country violates the very obligation of citizenship, our devotion to a core principle on which our nation was founded, that we, the people, not some foreign power that wishes us ill, we decide who shall govern us. Strong words, indeed, but Schiff knows perfectly well that Moscow's alleged involvement in the 2016 election, which was relatively insignificant, had no measurable impact on the result. By way of contrast, everyone in Washington knows very clearly that Israel has seriously corrupted the United States government and its elected officials at all levels. But Schiff did not mention Israel, nor did he express concern that Israel's clearly unsavory involvement with Trump transition team members General Michael Flynn and Jared Kushner was never thoroughly investigated or included in the final Mueller report. One might assume that a deliberate decision was made by some parties in power to avoid embarrassing Israel. Those parties almost certainly included Schiff. Schiff, who is Jewish, frequently tells audiences about his love for Israel, sometimes complaining that Israel is treated unfairly. It might be suggested that if anyone in the government is partial to a foreign power, it is Schiff, and that foreign power is Israel, not Russia. Unfortunately, Schiff is not unique. Perhaps he and a number of other congressmen should register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938, as required by law. Congressmen are not exempt when they act on behalf of a foreign nation, though they frequently believe themselves to be not covered by the very laws that they pass. In May, a letter was sent to the White House with the signatures of 400 congressmen, purely to express U.S. government solidarity with Israel and to give it a green light to do whatever it wishes vis-a-vis its neighbors. The letter cites some questionable American interests relating to Syria, but it also mentions Israel no fewer than 13 times. If that does not convince one that Congress is Israeli-occupied territory, check out some bills that have been working their way through the legislature. The House voted overwhelmingly on July 23 to formally oppose the Palestinian-backed nonviolent movement to boycott Israel. The measure, H.R.S. 246, opposes efforts to delegitimize the State of Israel in the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, BDS, targeting Israel. The bill had 349 co-sponsors and passed by a 398-17 vote. 16 Democrats and only one Republican opposed the bill. The bill is not a law but is rather intended to express the will of Congress, which is perhaps the only good thing to say about it. Other bills have not yet been voted on. They include the Aid to Israel Bill H.R. 1837, the United States-Israel Cooperation Enhancement and Regional Security Act, which has 279 co-sponsors. When the bill is approved, which it will be, it will increase the amount of aid given to Israel over 10 years to $38 billion, though this is now regarded as a minimum figure, and the aid is now unconditional, meaning that Israel will receive the money no matter how it behaves, while Israel will also be able to use the U.S. taxpayer-provided money to buy weapons from its own arms industry. cutting American defense contractors out of the loop and costing jobs in the United States. Another item on behalf of Israel is also pending, H.R. 1850, the Palestinian International Terrorism Support Prevention Act of 2019, a law that would authorize and encourage financially sanctioning any foreign organization or individual that provides support to any group, organization or individual considered to be part of the Palestinian resistance. Interestingly, the bill does not even pretend to be based on U.S. national security. It is all about and for Israel. One final bit of bipartisan legislation that has just appeared recently in the Senate will prioritize and pay for health care and nutrition services for those who claim to be Holocaust survivors. The bill is entitled the Trauma Informed Modernization of Elder Care for Holocaust Survivors Act or Time for Holocaust Survivors Act. It is intended to increase the chances that survivors could age in their own homes and also to ensure that Holocaust survivors have care and services tailored to their needs. Sponsor Senator Ben Cardin, DMD, who is Jewish, elaborated, Holocaust survivors came to the United States seeking refuge from unimaginable horrors. They have lived their lives here and enriched our nation. With an average age of 85, we have an obligation to provide Holocaust survivors the community support and special services they need to live out their final days. We have an obligation. How about you and your co-religionists, Ben, as you seem to have a lot of money to spend on lobbying for Israel? Special services, why do they need help? Because, the bill states, institutionalized settings, with confined spaces or restrictions on food, can induce panic, anxiety, and re-traumatization due to their Holocaust experiences. How the Senate will justify special benefits for a small group of self-described victims drawn from the wealthiest demographic in the U.S. remains to be seen. If there is anyone who actually needs help, it is a U.S. taxpayer, who has to bear the burden of this utter nonsense. That so-called Holocaust survivors, who are only Jews, no Christians who went through 1941 to 1945 in Europe need apply, though there were many, deserve special benefits from governments that other retirees cannot have is a disgrace. So, is the United States Congress Israeli and also, by extension, Zionist-occupied territory? I think the question answers itself. Yearly cultish confab continues. World's richest men assemble for bizarre ritual gathering at Bohemian Grove. By Donald Jeffries. Every July, some of the most recognizable names from the world of politics, business, and entertainment get together and celebrate in 2,700 wooded acres in the ancient redwood forest of Northern California. What they were celebrating, we're told, is nothing of significance to the world at large, but they did it all under the watchful gaze of a 40-foot-high hollow owl. Until Alex Jones snuck into Bohemian Grove in July 2000, the rumors about a giant owl couldn't be substantiated. Jones filmed the utterly bizarre cremation of care ceremony, during which a supposedly mock human sacrifice takes place, while hooded figures chant suitably occultish incantations. Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in journalism for young baby boomers, was the voice of the owl for years. The bathrooms are seldom used. Even Bill Clinton joked about peeing on the redwoods. The exclusively male nature of these festivities has not historically produced any protests from feminist groups, but this June, Sonoma County supervisors actually raised the appropriateness of providing deputies for an event that outright discriminates against women. I don't see how we can be providing law enforcement for a club that discriminates so blatantly, Shirley Zane, a county supervisor, stated. It's not just about men gathering. It's really about the purposeful exclusion of women, Linda Hopkins, another county supervisor, explained. She described having heard that there were Grove members and Grove leadership calling my male fellow elected officials. I became a little bit disenchanted, honestly, with their unwillingness to talk to a female leader about this. Despite this, the board ultimately voted to approve the security contract with Bohemian Grove. When Jones was covering this event more closely, he interviewed insiders who provided him with lots of juicy details of what supposedly really transpires behind the scenes there. In 2005, he spoke to an employee of the Grove, who worked during the 15-day summer encampment festival. He talked about scanners, motion detectors, and other increased security measures implemented in response to Jones's 2000 infiltration. Jones had previously reported that gay porn stars had been flown into the confab. There is a notorious photograph that purports to be Henry Kissinger in drag, performing a homosexual act while in attendance at the Grove. This curious ritual has taken place every July since 1878. Mark Twain was an early member, Bing Crosby, Merv Griffin, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Charlton Heston, Francis Ford Coppola, The Grateful Dead's Bob Weir, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Clint Eastwood are just some of the past and present names from the entertainment world that have frequented these summer festivals. The participants have tended to be more Republican, but plenty of Democrats have been there, too. Calvin Coolidge, Dwight Eisenhower, Franklin D. Roosevelt, J. Edgar Hoover, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, both Presidents Bush, assorted Supreme Court justices, astronauts like Wally Schirra, prominent nuclear physicist Edward Teller, gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson, former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, corporate elites like tire magnate Leonard Firestone, Bear Baron Joseph Coors, and the Koch brothers, and countless Rockefellers have been attendees. Herbert Hoover told of learning how he'd received the Republican Party's presidential nomination at the Grove. During the summer of 1928, Richard Nixon's comeback political career is said to have been hatched at the Grove, as was the Manhattan Project. Interestingly, indications are that Donald Trump has never been asked to this strange annual party. A 2014 post to the website Reddit supposedly from a Bohemian Grove employee related how the attendees stay drunk most of the time and openly proposition young male workers. He spoke of the gross popularity of urinating on trees, with diners just peeing on the redwoods in direct view of the tables where everyone was eating. The owl was a symbolic figure associated with child sacrifice going back to the Old Testament, combined with the seemingly mock sacrifice during the cremation of care ceremony. This should cause all Americans to be concerned. When one factors in all the child sex scandals this author covered in the book Hidden History and the recent arrest of multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein, who flew elite figures to his Lolita Island that featured underage girls, it is hard not to make some frightening connections. Even if no conspiratorial element is ascribed to all this, it is both objectionable and offensive that our leaders are gathering together in the woods to worship a giant stone owl and conduct occult ceremonies. At the very least, Bohemian Grove is decidedly troublesome and weird, like the annual Bilderberg meetings, where the world's corporate, political, and celebrity elite meet under the tightest security imaginable. Bohemian Grove provides credibility for those who believe shadowy figures are conspiring against the general public behind the scenes. Anti-Antifa bills threaten Bolshevik terror network. By John Friend, recent bills introduced in both the House and Senate have Antifa groups across the country outraged at the prospect of being declared a domestic terror organization, as the debate over right wing and left wing political violence escalates in the wake of three mass shootings that took place from July 28 to August 4. Late last month, Senators Ted Cruz, R. Texas, and Bill Cassidy, Arla, introduced a non-binding Senate resolution declaring Antifa, the collection of various radical left-wing communist and anarchist activist groups that regularly engage in political violence, disrupt right-leaning political events, and otherwise interfere with the constitutionally protected free speech rights of conservatives, a domestic terrorist organization. Antifa terrorists, violent masked bullies who fight fascism with actual fascism, protected by liberal privilege, Sen. Cassidy said in a statement after announcing the introduction of the resolution. Bullies get their way until someone says no. Elected officials must have courage, not cowardice, to prevent terror. A similar House resolution, introduced on July 25 by Rep. Brian Fitzpatrick, R. Penn, shortly after the Senate resolution's introduction, also seeks to label Antifa a domestic terrorist organization. The text of the House resolution correctly notes that Antifa views the dissemination and expression of right-leaning political perspectives as the equivalence of violence. It also points out that Antifa represents opposition to the democratic ideals of peaceful assembly and free speech for all, and that members of Antifa have physically assaulted journalists and other individuals during protests and riots. In one such recent high-profile event, independent journalist and conservative writer Andy Ngo was violently punched and kicked by a mob of Antifa-affiliated activists at a rally in Portland, or in late June. The violent assault garnered national media attention, forcing a spotlight on violence committed by Antifa and other left-wing radicals. Following the announcement of the resolutions, a collection of Antifa-affiliated groups and organizations released a statement in opposition, arguing that Republican congressional representatives are seeking to explicitly target their political opposition. In the statement, which was posted on the Rose City Antifa website and endorsed by over 90 other Antifa-affiliated groups across the country, the groups insist that the resolutions are based on a manufactured threat which only exists in the absence of critical thought and inquiry, dismissing the very real and well-documented violence committed by their cohorts. The greatest domestic political threat in the U.S. today is the far right, they allege in their statement. The disconnect between the radical far left and the reality of political violence in American society could not be more apparent. President Trump, whose supporters have been violently attacked by Antifa and other radical left-wing activists and criminals since he launched his presidential campaign in 2015, invoked the resolutions on Twitter late last month, but thus far has not publicly supported either of them. Consideration is being given to declaring Antifa the gutless radical left whack jobs who go around hitting only non-fighters, people over the heads with baseball bats, a major organization of terror, along with MS-13 and others. The president tweeted on July 27, would make it easier for police to do their job. In the wake of the mass shootings in both El Paso and Dayton, the alleged threat of white supremacist terrorism has been elevated and advanced, even by the president himself, despite the fact that the alleged shooter in Dayton, Connor Betts, was a known left-wing radical. According to CNN, Betts operated a now-deleted Twitter account that retweeted extreme left-wing and anti-police posts, as well as tweets supporting Antifa, or anti-fascist, protesters, Antifa groups and other far-left lobbying and activist organizations, such as the Southern Poverty Law Center and Anti-Defamation League, along with liberal Democrats, have long argued that right-wing political violence is on the rise and represents a grave threat to American society. Following the shootings last weekend, virtually the entire political and media establishment has promoted the idea that violence inspired by white supremacists and white nationalists represents the biggest threat to America, despite the countless examples of violence inspired by and carried out by radical left-wing activists. In an address to the nation earlier this week, President Trump urged the country to condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy, arguing that these sinister ideologies must be defeated. No mention was made of left-wing violence, including a recent violent assault on a legal immigrant who was wearing Trump's signature Make America Great Again hat in New York City, or the attempted fire bombing of an ICE facility in Washington State by an Antifa-affiliated activist. Despite the endless condemnation of white supremacist terrorism and the alleged threat of right-wing violence, particularly in the wake of the recent shootings, which have once again shaken the nation, President Trump and his Republican colleagues would be wise to focus their attention on the ongoing threat posed by the radical left to free speech and assembly and other cherished political traditions in America. The tankard had for tat, thankfully. It appears Trump wants no part of this conflict. By Richard Walker. The tit for tat oil tanker seizures, first by Britain and in response by Iran, could lead to a naval conflict in the Persian Gulf that the Royal Navy might not be able to handle alone. Iran's seizure of a British registered tanker in the Strait of Hormuz, a narrow channel between Iran and Oman through which much of the world's oil is transported, exposed the Royal Navy's sparse protection resources. The American conservative calls the strait the most dangerous place on Earth. At a time when Britannia no longer rules the waves, it has become starkly clear to Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson that the Royal Naval is no longer a powerful force. It simply lacks the capability to protect British shipping in the Gulf and is only 25% of the size it was during the 1982 Falklands War with Argentina. Nevertheless, Johnson has sent a second warship to the Gulf, while appealing at the same time to European nations to help him establish a naval protection force to provide security for tankers passing through the Strait of Hormuz. Interestingly, Britain has very little shipping passing through the strait. There is nevertheless an already sizable U.S. naval force in the Gulf, and adding more firepower could well have unintentional consequences that could spark a war. The irony of that is that in May, British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt warned that the U.S. Iran policy of sending a large naval force to the Middle East risked a war with Iran. He said, "We are very worried about the risk of a conflict happening by accident with an escalation that is unintended. Now, it is Europeans who are concerned that Britain may be the nation escalating tensions that could spark a wider conflict. Washington, in contrast, has been sitting by watching this crisis unfold, and has not suggested coming to Britain's aid. By all accounts, the Trump administration expects Europeans to protect their own shipping." Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has made that clear, pointing out in several interviews that it is Europe's responsibility to protect its vessels. A British diplomat, based in Brussels, found the Washington stance at best duplicitous. Speaking to this reporter off the record, he said the tanker crisis was coming at a time when Brexit was dominating the headlines, and in some quarters in Brussels there was genuine fear that at any moment another tanker seizure by Iran could lead to a clash between British and Iranian naval vessels, putting out of reach the prospect of a tanker swap deal with Iran and raising the stakes militarily. He had this to say about Washington's confusing role in this crisis: EU nations are willing to join a British protection force, but only if it is not part of Washington's anti-Iran strategy. It has been made clear by European ministers that they will not support Washington's efforts to strangle Iran's economy. Germany has been very upfront about it. The diplomat refused to comment on whether Britain has faced criticism in EU capitals for sparking this crisis after it authorized Royal Marines to board and seize the Iranian-registered oil tanker Grace I in Spanish waters off the British colony of Gibraltar on July 4. The British claimed that the ship was transporting Iranian oil to Syria. However, there is a widespread belief in EU diplomatic circles that Britain seized the vessel at the behest of Washington, fully aware that it would likely lead to a response from Iran, which it did. Meanwhile, the U.S. mainstream media has paid little attention to Britain's justification for boarding the Grace I with a heavily armed force. New British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab claimed the vessel was seized in compliance with international law, but there is no international law determining who Iran sells its oil to, and there is an EU mechanism in place to ease the sanctions imposed on Iran by the Trump administration as it has ratcheted up its efforts to destroy the Iranian economy, a strategy advocated by U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton. If the Iranian tanker was, as the British claimed, transporting oil to Syria, it was within Iran's legal right to do so. Sanctions were last imposed on Syria by the Barack Obama administration, and those have been ignored by the major powers with the exception of the United States. That fact alone, and the seizure of the Iranian vessel in international waters, has not deterred the U.S. mainstream media from mispresenting the crisis as the result of Iran breaking sanctions and seizing a British tanker in the Persian Gulf. Discussions about the crisis in European capitals have been much more nuanced than in Washington, where there is a constant level of anti-Iran hysteria. As a consequence, some European leaders have suggested a tanker swap, but Iran fears that will not happen while elements in London argue for military action instead of diplomatic dialogue. In the narrow Strait of Hormuz, the risk of what some are calling unintended consequences remains high, meaning a possible false flag attack. So far, Iran has offered to solve the crisis with a tanker swap, but the British have turned it down. That did not deter the new British leader's father, Stanley Johnson, from proffering his opinion about the issue in what has been dubbed a bizarre political gaffe. He told Iranian television viewers that his son loved Iran and could solve the crisis easy peasy. Tulsi Gabbard sues Google anti-war candidate. Educational outfits say tech giant a threat to democracy, by St. Patrick Rep. Tulsi Gabbard, D. Hawaii, is suing internet company Google for its increased ideological censorship. After the first Democratic Party debate aired on NBC, Gabbard was the most sought-for candidate on Google. At a time when interest in her decidedly anti-war campaign peaked, the tech goliath blocked her Google Ads account. Gabbard also charged that Google sent her campaign emails to Gmail spam folders at a disproportionately high rate. The Gabbard campaign is seeking a legal injunction against Google so that the world's largest search engine can no longer meddle in the 2020 elections, presidential or otherwise. The campaign is also seeking $50 million in damages. As stated in Gabbard's legal complaint against Google, for hours, as millions of Americans searched Google for information about Tulsi, and as Tulsi was trying, through Google, to speak to them, her Google Ads account was arbitrarily and forcibly taken offline. Throughout this period, the campaign worked frantically to gather more information about the suspension, to get through to someone at Google who could get the account back online, and to understand and remedy the restraint that had been placed on Tulsi's speech. At precisely the moment when everyone wanted to hear from her, Google controls 88% of the internet searches in the US, which means essentially that American access to information online goes through Google. Gabbard sees the dangers for US elections if Google continues its censorship. Google's discrimination against our campaign reveals the danger of their dominance and how the dominance of big tech over public discourse threatens core American values, Gabbard tweeted on July 25. They threaten our democracy, Google responded shortly thereafter, not surprisingly stating that there's no bias, political, ideological, or otherwise, in their decisions. In this case, our system triggered a suspension and the account was reinstated shortly thereafter, said Google spokeswoman Reeva Sutto. We are proud to offer ad products that help campaigns connect directly with voters, and we do so without bias toward any party or political ideology. There are other organizations that would vehemently disagree with Sutto and agree with Gabbard. In 2018, rogue Google employees contacted the conservative Breitbart News to inform them that there was a culture within Google that was actively working against Breitbart's Google Ads monetization plan. Leftist employees at Google had sent management an open letter stating that Googlers hold a diverse set of political, social, and economic perspectives, but respect and openness bind us together. The hate and bullying Breitbart incites toward Muslims, LGBTQ people, and women is incompatible with those shared values. Prager was a conservative educational video company created by Dennis Prager. It is now also suing Google and YouTube for censorship of its educational material. The suit cites over 50 videos that have been either demonetized or restricted by Google, which owns YouTube. The restricted or demonetized videos include Why America Must Lead, The Ten Commandments, Do Not Murder, Why Did America Fight the Korean War, and The World's Most Persecuted Minority, Christians. When Prager inquired to Google and YouTube about the censorship, they were told that the videos had been restricted because they were deemed inappropriate for younger audiences. Prager's founder disagrees. Watch any one of our videos and you'll immediately realize that Google YouTube censorship is entirely ideologically driven, stated Dennis Prager. For the record, our videos are presented by some of the finest minds in the Western world, including four Pulitzer Prize winners, former prime ministers, and professors from the most prestigious universities in America. YouTube currently has 1.3 billion users worldwide. Restricting access to material on YouTube is restricting free speech globally. YouTube has long been censoring alternative voices. Podcast hosts Brent Holland and Ed Opperman have both been demonetized down to an irreparable status, crippling their shows. The censoring of Gabbard is new in that it is not usually Democrats or any left-leaning entities that are censored by Google, but Gabbard is a different kind of candidate than the rest of the field. She is the only candidate in the debates who is challenging the perpetual war state and the mainstream media lies on foreign policy. She has gone against the grain on the issues of war and peace, and now she is suing the largest gatekeeper in the world. Internet censorship nightmare, AI, artificial idiocy, rules the day, by Dr. Kevin Barrett's internet censorship rages ever further out of control. Content creators have joked that soon the only acceptable posts will be cat-chasing laser pointer videos. The way things are going, however, even the cats are starting to worry. There are so many instances of egregiously idiotic internet censorship that no brief article could possibly even scratch the surface, so I will limit myself to a few cases that have recently come to my attention. Comedian Adam Garrison makes his living, or should I say made his living, before the censorship hammer came down, poking fun at both liberals and conservatives. He lampoons a liberal character, Dan Myers, and his conservative doppelganger, Rusty Myers, suddenly, for no discernible reason, and with no explanation, Facebook deleted his account, wiping out all of his videos, which totaled tens of millions of views. Simultaneously, YouTube banned only his conservative Rusty Myers videos, but not his liberal Dan Myers ones. Is YouTube run by conservatives who don't mind comedians poking fun at liberals but can't handle anyone ridiculing Trump supporters? Hardly. The truth is precisely the opposite. YouTube's liberal owners, or their AI, artificial idiocy-driven censorship algorithms, thought Rusty Myers was a real Trump supporter, and banned him on that basis. On Black Op Radio, Adam Garrison explained, "I think they were trying to silence anything, especially getting close to the 2020 election, supporting Trump. As the Rusty Myers character, I always wore a Trump shirt in the videos, and they took it down because they don't like people, even in jest, agreeing with President Trump." Prior to 1987, the Federal Communications Commission's FCC fairness doctrine required broadcasters to provide balanced coverage. Today, internet oligarchs, who command audiences even bigger than the broadcast networks, apparently think they can ban anyone who even appears to support the wrong presidential candidate, or who otherwise disagrees with them in any way. If President Donald Trump wants his supporters to continue to enjoy their constitutional right to free speech, he should consider ordering the FCC to reimpose the fairness doctrine. The new fairness doctrine for the internet age should make it clear that big social media companies must respect the First Amendment. Constitutionally protected speech obviously cannot be banned from the new digital town square of social media. Better yet, Trump should order the antitrust division of the Justice Department to seize the big social media companies, which are illegal monopolies, and either break them into tiny pieces or run them as public utilities under the full protection of the First Amendment. The latter option makes more sense, because social media outfits are natural monopolies, like the post office, the highway department, the public schools, and the utilities that provide us with electricity and water. Another example of the absurd overreach of the current censorship epidemic: on July 21, YouTube banned my interfaith dialogue with Duvid, a Jewish American from Detroit who is one of the most eloquent advocates for his chosen faith. According to YouTube, we had violated their guidelines prohibiting hate speech, but there was nothing remotely hateful in our friendly, respectful conversation. I can only think of two possible reasons why the video could have been banned. First, the word Jew occurs twice in the title. Kevin Barrett asks Duvid what makes a Jew a Jew, and what is anti-Semitism? The same artificially idiotic algorithm that thought Adam Garrison's Rusty Myers character was a real Trump supporter may have thought that only Jew haters use the word Jew. Additionally, Duvid and I are both critics of Zionism. Maybe YouTube's AI thought that anyone who criticizes Zionism and uses the word Jew is a suitable censorship target. In any case, after review by actual human beings, YouTube upheld my appeal and reinstated the video. Unfortunately, this rare example of sanity is the exception that proves the rule. While I was battling YouTube over the Duvid interview, Vimeo suddenly banned my internet TV show False Flag Weekly News. Their new guidelines prohibit content that falsely claims that mass tragedies are hoaxes. The word hoax is defined as a humorous or malicious deception. So telling the truth about the mass tragedy of 9/11, that it was a malicious deception, is no longer permitted on Vimeo. The unfortunate truth is that many, if not most, mass tragedies are in fact malicious deceptions. Every war is a mass tragedy, And virtually every war is a malicious deception in that people are conned into going to war by lying politicians. The Charles Manson murders and the Jonestown massacre were mass tragedies, and both were malicious deceptions orchestrated by such CIA mind control specialists as Dr. Lewis Jolly and Jolly West. False flags are by definition mass tragedies based on malicious deception, but in post 9/11 America, are we allowed to say that? A sad day in court for men's group activist judge gives right-wingers max sentences, ignores real criminals. July 19 was a grim day for three young men from the Rise Above movement, RAM, who were told their punishment by a federal district judge in Charlottesville, VA. The defendants had been arrested under the Anti-Riot Act, which a California federal court has found unconstitutional, and charged for their participation in the 2018 riots in Charlottesville in California, denied bail. The RAM defendants, after many months in difficult conditions in prison, had entered into plea agreements in May 2019, a few weeks prior to the sentencing hearing and long after the plea agreements were entered into. The government announced its intention to try to increase, by means of the Federal Hate Crime Enhancement Statute, part of the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, 28 U.S.C. Sec. 2800003, the sentences to which the RAM defendants agreed in their plea agreements. The Hate Crime Enhancement Statute allows a court to increase a defendant's prison time if the court determines that the defendant, in committing a federal crime, for example, rioting, singled out members of a protected group, such as racial minorities, women, or homosexual persons. At the hearing, the government put forward a massive effort to make its proposed hate crime enhancements stick. It called two FBI agents as witnesses and introduced and discussed over 60 exhibits, mostly photographs and videos, and invoked comparisons to Nazi Germany. The hearing, however, had an air of Kafka-esque, bizarre unreality. During the entire hearing, the government and its FBI witnesses ignored or mitigated the provocative, aggressive, and often violent actions of the counter-protesters, which included Antifa and other hard-left radicals. At the Charlottesville and California confrontations, for example, one of the government's photo exhibits showed a RAM defendant holding a bagel and making a hand gesture that the government described as a white power sign. Standing next to the RAM defendant was a man who was friends with the RAM defendant. The government presented this photo as evidence that the RAM defendants were anti-Semitic and were targeting Jews at the riots. What the government failed to mention and defense counsel failed to elicit on cross-examination was that bagels had been thrown at the RAM defendants by the neo-Bolshevik Antifa agitators and their allies, and the man standing next to the RAM defendant was later viciously assaulted with a bike lock and injured by a masked Antifa member. This masked Antifa member was Eric Clanton, then a professor at a college in Berkeley. Clanton was charged with a misdemeanor for his assault, received a suspended sentence of 30 days, was placed on probation, and thus served no jail time. As another example, the government showed a video clip of one of the RAM defendants punching an Antifa activist. What the government failed to mention, and defense cross-examination only partly brought out, was that the Antifa activist was masked and was charging provocatively up a set of steps toward the RAM defendant. As another example, one of the FBI agents was asked on cross-examination to identify the counter-protesters who appeared in many of the government's photo exhibits wearing t-shirts urging violent communist revolution. The FBI agent's response was essentially that he had not investigated and had no clear idea who the communist revolutionaries were, what types of violent revolutionary tactics they advocated and practiced, or what role they played in the riots for which the RAM defendants were charged under the Anti-Riot Act. Evidently, the FBI has neglected to fully investigate such things as neo-Bolshevik violence, a situation that will hopefully change as a result of proposed federal legislation declaring Antifa a domestic terror organization. As a final example, the government introduced a statement from a bartender in which he claimed he overheard one of the RAM defendants stating after the riots, "Next we're going after the feminists." The government argued this was evidence the RAM defendants were targeting women. Overlooked was one, the statement was double hearsay, two, It was allegedly made after the riots. 3. Not all feminists are women. And 4. Going after the feminists does not necessarily imply violence. Obviously, Mindreders had been employed to determine the defendant's intent. Unfortunately, the First Amendment rights of non-leftist protesters are of no real concern to activist judges today, most of whom are too scared to buck the narrative that white people who do not support neo-Bolshevism and anarchism are all dangerous terrorists. On one level, the government's attempt to add hate crime enhancements to the RAM defendant's sentences failed, for the court rejected the attempt, but at another level, and probably the one the government really intended, the attempt was successful, for after seeing and hearing for nearly an hour the government's had a crime evidence, the court imposed on all three RAM defendants prison sentences at or near the maximums allowed under their plea agreements. One received 27 months, a second 33 months, and the third 37 months for their involvement in scuffles at, with the exception of a few counter-protesters whose faces were bloodied, significantly injured no one. The RAM defendants had no connection to James Fields, who drove his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing one woman, and the government did not even assert any such connection. Contrast this with the one-month suspended sentence and three-year probation Clanton received for smashing a bike lock into a man's face. There's your wondrous criminal justice system at work, folks, not a bit political. The Free Expression Foundation, FEF, plans to submit an amicus, friend of the court, brief in support of the Charlottesville RAM defendant's appeal to the Fourth Circuit. FEF also plans to submit an amicus brief in opposition to the appeal to the Ninth Circuit filed by the government in the parallel California RAM prosecution, in which the trial court found the Anti-Riot Act unconstitutional, dismissed the indictment, and freed the RAM defendants. FEF, a 501(c)(3), welcomes and will prudently and effectively use financial support. Free speech worth supporting. Free Expression Foundation needs help in this huge battle by Paul Angel. Getting free speech rights would be really easy these days if we donned black masks and helmets, threw on some all-black military fatigues, grabbed a few bags of dog poo and a truncheon, and showed up to harass anyone showing pride in America or our U.S. culture heroes. Who knows? You might even be able to slam seven people in the head with a metal bike lock and get away with it, as did college professor and anti-free speech activist Eric Clanton. Fortunately, however, we here at the Free Expression Foundation, FEF, believe in the rule of law, and we believe in free speech for everyone, whether you are a red leftist or an ultra-conservative red, white, and blue patriot. But, we are sad to say, that is not the way those in charge think in America today. You know that's true, because, every once in a while, you turn on the TV and sit through a fink broadcast, the fake industrial news complex. You may have also realized that never before in American history has the news been so blatantly fictional. Every mass shooter is a white supremacist, even if he or she is for universal health care, saving gay whales, stopping apocalyptic climate change, or inspired by communist rep Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for instance. The fascist shooter in the recent El Paso massacre described himself as a progressive leftist. In his manifesto, he warned that, the media will probably call me a white supremacist anyway and blame Trump's rhetoric. He then stated, the media is infamous for fake news. Their reaction to this attack will likely just confirm that. But who cares about that truth? And who cares about open and stimulating political debate? Certainly not the Democrats, who have adopted the bogus narrative that white people in general and conservative white males in particular, the worst plague to have infected mankind since the first flea jumped off the first rat and bit a human, passing on the Yersinia pestis bacterium, thus kicking off the Black Death. Leftists today are only concerned about acquiring complete political power, and they will support any lie to regain the White House. And, really, the Republicans are hardly better, scratching and clawing over one another to claim their spot on the censorship bandwagon. We can't count on them to protect free speech and to defend those whose First Amendment rights are being fed through the shredder. We'll have to do this ourselves, average Americans and the Free Expression Foundation. Right now it is conservatives who are bearing the brunt of the assault on free speech, but tomorrow it could be the left. We don't really make an ideological distinction about whose rights we support. As long as those battling for free speech do not espouse violence, we will support them all. Right now, however, it is conservatives who need our help the most. For those who wonder if a fledgling organization can make a difference, ask those defendants who were set free in California after an attorney representing FEF played a major role in swaying a judge to rule that the Anti-Riot Act is unconstitutional. This was a huge victory, and we expect many more, but we need funds. Want to join us? Send a check or money order made out to FEF and mail it to P.O. Box 1479, Upper Marlboro, Doctor of Medicine 20773 today. Global Gun Control Rejected, President Aims to Kill You and At, by Mark Anderson. The United Nations Arms Trade Treaty, At, which the National Association for Gun Rights, NAGR, has described as the gun control lobby's crown jewel for decades, entered into force 5 years ago this coming December, while the U.S. signed the treaty under President Barack Obama. The pact, which includes provisions for regulating small arms like those used by civilians and police officers, never received the Senate ratification that the Constitution requires for all treaties. Enter Senate Resolution, S. Res. 204, introduced by Senator Rand Paul, Archi, with minimal fanfare on May 13. S. Res. 204 would prevent ratification by transferring the treaty back to the White House where President Donald Trump could deactivate it. If, on the other hand, the treaty is not returned, it will remain in the Senate and could come up for a ratification vote at any time. As long as the treaty is pending in the Senate, ratification is all that's needed for this gun grab to become reality, regardless of who occupies the White House or their position on the treaty, a NAGR News Bulletin warned. Trump has gone on record as being opposed to the treaty, which soon may catch the attention of gun control advocates in big media and many politicians in the Democrat Party, who are recklessly connecting the most recent multiple casualty shootings in El Paso, Texas and Dayton, Ohio with Trump's statements and policies. Speaking at the National Rifle Association's annual conference in Indianapolis April 26, Trump stated, "Under my administration we will never surrender American sovereignty to anyone. We will never allow foreign bureaucrats to trample on your Second Amendment freedoms, and that is why my administration will never ratify the UN Arms Trade Treaty, and I am officially announcing today that the U.S. will be revoking the effect of our signature on this badly misguided treaty. We're taking our signature back. The UN will soon receive formal notice that America is rejecting this treaty." The crowd at the NRA event responded in uproarious applause when Trump then signed an official communication on the NRA's podium to inform the Senate of his position against treaty ratification. Paul confirmed that Trump followed through. Shortly after his announcement, President Trump, on April 29, sent a message to the Senate requesting it return the AT, Arms Trade Treaty, which the Obama administration had submitted to it in the closing weeks of the 114th Congress in 2016 for ratification. "I applaud President Trump for responding to concerns I and many other Americans have raised in rejecting this UN power grab," according to the brief text of Paul's resolution. Trump's exact words to the Senate were, "I have concluded that it is not in the interest of the United States to become a party to the Arms Trade Treaty." Senate Treaty Doc 114-14, transmitted December 9, 2016. "I have, therefore, decided to withdraw the aforementioned treaty from the Senate and accordingly request that it be returned to me." So far, 104 nations have ratified the AT, and another 32, including the U.S., have signed but not ratified it. The AT's backers maintain that the treaty respects national-level gun laws and constitutional safeguards of private firearms ownership, while saying that one of the treaty's chief functions is to make sure arms shipments are not rerouted to terrorist groups. The Institute for Legislative Action, the NRA's lobbying arm, stated in July 2012, "Anti-gun treaty proponents continue claiming the treaty would have no impact on American gun owners. This is a bald-faced lie. For example, The most recent draft treaty includes export-import controls that would require officials in an importing country to collect information on the end user, keep the information for 20 years, and provide the information to the country from which the gun was exported. In other words, if someone bought a Beretta shotgun, they would be considered an end user, and the U.S. government would have to keep a record of the buyer and notify the Italian government about the purchase. That amounts to international gun registration, treaty opponents say. The UN noted online that the Landmark Act regulates the entire international trade in conventional arms, from small arms to battle tanks, combat aircraft, and warships. According to the Library of Congress, SRS 204 was sent to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations the day Paul introduced it, where it has been marooned with no hearings or votes held or scheduled. Fortunately, the House does not involve itself in resolutions of this sort, so it suggested that AFP readers call their Senator State and D.C. offices, nationally dial the Capitol switchboard at 202-224-3121, and ask for any senator, and urge movement on this resolution, raising red flags about red flag laws. Who will decide if a gun owner is a threat, and can we trust the decision? By Mark Anderson. It's pretty obvious to anyone paying attention that the ruling elite want more stringent gun confiscation laws enacted. One proposed way to do this is via the institution of red flag laws. Red flag laws are allegedly designed to prevent future mass shootings, as they empower courts to take guns away from potentially dangerous people. As if we can actually trust the courts to be impartial arbiters in this matter. We wish we could. Red flag laws have already been put in place in 17 states, of which 12 enacted them after the Parkland, Florida school shooting in February 2018. Four other states have proposed such laws. For the record, the two states in which high-profile multiple shootings recently took place, at an El Paso, Texas Walmart and a Dayton, Ohio entertainment venue, do not yet have red flag laws on the books. Though Ohio had already proposed such a law, on the federal level, at a March 26 congressional committee hearing entitled Red Flag Laws, Examining Guidelines for State Action, Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC, noted, while Republicans and Democrats, on this committee and across America, can disagree on the Second Amendment, what's clear is that recent tragedies in the United States are examples of a failure to identify and lessen risk from individuals who may be showing signs of distress and the willingness to hurt themselves or others. The use of extreme risk protection orders, also known as red flag orders, have shown promise in the states. Red flag laws generally work by a family or household member or law enforcement officer petitioning a court to temporarily restrict an individual's ability to buy or access firearms. The burden of proof is placed on law enforcement to prove the person in question has become an imminent danger, and there is a due process right for the individual to challenge the determination. Politically, these laws are found in red, blue, and purple states. In March 2018, the Trump administration called on every state to enact extreme risk protection orders. The potential for President Trump to bend to media-induced pressure, perhaps to protect himself politically as the 2020 election nears, is high given the tense and uncertain climate created by news of the latest shootings. The key to understanding the potential problems with red flag laws is realizing that such laws could easily morph into large-scale disarmament of law-abiding civilians based upon their political philosophy. Indeed, confiscations could become ever more frequent, not just family members and police, but also neighbors, acquaintances, and co-workers, possibly with an axe to grind, could conjure up reports of your suspicious or errant behavior, leading to firearms confiscation pending a review of your mental stability. In Connecticut, the justifications for gun confiscation have included such simple concerns as conflict between intimate partners, emotional distress over finances, and sadness of loss in old age, as reported February 25 in the Denver Post. Interestingly, the Post, citing the Sandy Hook school shooting in December 2012, added, Connecticut law enforcement had been temporarily taking weapons from at-risk people for more than a decade at the time of the shooting. According to the Duke University study, about 140 orders were issued in 2012, but Adam Lanza, The 20-year-old responsible for that elementary school massacre wasn't the registered owner of the guns he used to commit murder. Investigative reports insist he used his mother's guns to kill her at home and 26 children and adults at the elementary school. Another more troubling aspect of the situation is that mainstream-controlled media reports on mass shootings are not based in reality. They invariably portray the shooter as a trigger-happy white supremacist, despite any real facts to support that contention. Thus, the first segment of the population to be disarmed, due to fake news-induced media hysteria, would most likely be white nationalists, just the very people who are most resistant to the expansion of the New World Order policed state. Coincidence? Probably not. President bends to pressure, pardons Dershowitz clients first Mordecai Rubashkin, now Ronan Namini, by John Friend late last month. President Donald Trump commuted the prison sentence of an Israeli-born Orthodox Jewish drug dealer named Ronan Namini, a decision that was strongly supported by many notable leaders from across the political spectrum. According to an official White House statement announcing the president's action, Namini had been found guilty by a Miami federal court jury in 2015 of manufacturing and distributing synthetic marijuana, an extremely dangerous drug commonly referred to as spice or K2. The Israeli-born man was sentenced to 20 years in prison but will now be released at the behest of the president. Evidence presented during his 2015 trial demonstrated that Namini imported multi-kilo shipments of illegal substances from China used to manufacture synthetic marijuana meant for distribution across Florida and the United States. Mr. Namini is a nonviolent, first-time offender with no criminal history, the White House statement noted. He has five young children at home and his wife is suffering from terminal cancer. These extenuating circumstances underscore the urgency of his request for clemency. Multiple congressional representatives, including both current and former Congress members, several senior Department of Justice officials, and countless other legal scholars and prosecutors, all lobbied the president to commute Namini's sentence. Alan Dershowitz and Gary Apfel, Namini's primary lawyers, worked tirelessly to free their client. Both Dershowitz and Apfel also worked on the legal team of Shalom Mordecai Rubashkin, another Orthodox Jewish criminal whose prison sentence was commuted by President Trump in December 2017. As was the case with Namini, Rubashkin had countless advocates working on his behalf to lobby the president to commute his sentence. "I'm still trying to catch my breath because I'm so overwhelmed. I can't believe what happened, and I'm so grateful," Namini's wife told Hamodia, an Orthodox Jewish news outlet. "I don't even have words in the dictionary to describe how grateful I am, how blessed I feel, and how overwhelmed I am with the joy in my heart." While President Trump is commuting the prison sentences of Orthodox Jewish criminals, countless political prisoners continue to languish in prison for manufactured crimes allegedly committed during the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in the summer of 2017. On July 19, three members of the Rise Above movement, RAM, a California-based physical fitness and men's improvement organization affiliated with the broader alt-right movement, were sentenced in the U.S. District Court in Charlottesville on charges relating to their participation in the rally. See related story on page 24. Benjamin Daly, Michael Mizilis, and Thomas Gillen were all convicted on conspiracy to riot charges, with each man being sentenced to considerable prison time. Daly, one of the founders of RAM, was sentenced to over 3 years in prison while Mizilis was sentenced to 27 months and Gillen to 33 months. Many have argued that Daly, Mizilis, and Gillen, along with other participants in the rally, were merely defending themselves in altercations with violent left-wing protesters, who were intent on disrupting and shutting down the legally permitted rally. Local political and law enforcement officials did little to prevent the violence from occurring and actually encouraged it by forcing the two opposing factions to face off with one another. The HIFI report, an independent review of the Unite the Right rally published by Hutton and Williams LLP, made clear that local authorities were not at all interested in allowing the legally permitted rally to take place. They allege that local authorities, including the police chief, actually wanted violence to ensue in order to declare the rally an unlawful assembly. Even under President Trump, The American justice system proves once again that special privileges are meted out to those with certain political and religious convictions. India versus Monsanto. Farmers in India rejecting genetically modified seeds. By Mark Anderson. In this age of seemingly unstoppable corporate government collusion and power, it's refreshing to see some promising pushback. India's cotton farmers represent a courageous case in point. Even before the arid nation began suffering from its current widespread water shortages, which were at least partly attributable to corporate giant Coca-Cola steadily slurping water out of the nation's aquifers, the farmers there had started rebelling against agri-giant Monsanto by refusing to continue farming the genetically modified cotton that the notoriously ruthless company claims is India's best option as a staple crop. That modified cotton, called BT cotton, that is, Bacillus thuringiensis, has a genetically modified seed that contains a bacterium by that name. Its chief feature is that it produces toxins that are said to be harmful to a variety of insects, including bollworms, which attack cotton plants. However, just as weeds become stronger against weed-killing formulas, many organisms also become stronger against genetic mutations of Mother Nature's creations. The website naturalblaze.com noted, after illegally pushing BT cotton into India and Africa over 10 years ago, Monsanto is now losing millions of dollars due to farmers now planting their own indigenous seed. Notably, according to Monsanto itself, insect resistance to Bacillus thuringiensis is natural and to be expected. India's government, amid the controversy, took to promoting the use of indigenous cotton seed and has called attention to what is seen as Monsanto's illegal profiteering from the BT cotton seed. The year 2017 alone saw Monsanto lose nearly $75 million in royalties, or about 5 billion rupees, due to farmers changing their seed choice, Natural Blaze reports. Consequently, sales figures in India fell by 15%. And while that sounds like a relatively small market share, it's had a discernible impact on Monsanto's bottom line. But the most serious factor is that, according to UK Daily Mail reports, some 300,000 farm deaths between 1995 and 2013 have been attributed, directly or indirectly, to Monsanto's practices, even while, according to several reports, farmer suicides throughout India's cotton belt, Maharashtra, have also been linked to those practices. Keshav Rajkranthi, who heads India's Central Institute for Cotton Research, said that if this market shift continues as is, bringing back indigenous seed to drive out the modified stuff, Monsanto's presence in India conceivably could end. Just wait for the crucial 3 to 4 years to see a complete, natural turnaround. By then most farmers will give up BT cotton and go for the indigenous variety, he told the Reuters news service. Notably, indigenous cotton varieties, according to some studies, fare better against the bollworm, whitefly, drought, and other dangers that loom over cotton farmers. But, all told, recapturing the indigenous crop completely could take decades or possibly generations to achieve. Such is the reality of countering the bitter fruits of unbridled, unlawful globalization, foisted upon the peoples of the world without their consent. Who is exploiting tragedy for political gain? By Patrick J. Buchanan. It was 2 days of contrast that tell us about America 2019. In El Paso, Texas and Dayton, Ohio, following the mass murders of Saturday and Sunday morning, the local folks on camera, police, prosecutors, mayors, FBI, and city officials, were nonpartisan, patient, polite, and dignified in the unity and solemnity of their grief for their dead and wounded. But for the Democratic presidential candidates, the El Paso atrocity was like a loose football in the Super Bowl. A mad scramble broke out over who would be first and most savage in indicting President Donald Trump for moral complicity in mass murder. Never let a crisis go to waste is an old political adage, and this crowd of candidates was not going to let that happen. Yet the naked political exploitation of these horrific acts, before the bodies of many had been removed from the crime scene, was appalling to behold. Learning in Las Vegas of the slaughter at the Walmart in El Paso, his hometown, Beto O'Rourke flew back that same day and sped to the scene, railed Beto, Trump is a racist and he stokes racism in this country and it leads to violence. We have a president with white nationalist views in the United States today. He called Trump's language about Mexican immigrants reminiscent of something you might hear in the Third Reich. Asked on Sunday by CNN's Jake Tapper if he believes the president is a white nationalist, Beto eagerly assented, "Yes, I do, Senator Bernie Sanders, IVT." Asked by Tapper if he agreed with Beto, replied, "I do. It gives me no pleasure to say this. All of the evidence out there suggests that we have a president who is a racist, who is a xenophobe, who appeals, and is trying to appeal, to white nationalism." On this same CNN show, Senator Cory Booker, DNJ, almost outdid Beto. "I want to say with more moral clarity that Donald Trump is responsible for this mass murder in El Paso, because he is stoking fear and hatred and bigotry," Booker went on. "We have a president of the United States who is savagely fraying the bonds of our nation by speaking consistently words of hatred, words of division, words of demonization and demagoguery. He is fueling an environment where white supremacists are finding more and more license to strike out against the vulnerable, to strike out against the immigrant, to strike out against the other." Booker is saying Trump is rendering moral license to race conflict. Senator Elizabeth Warren, DeMass, issued a statement, "We need to call out white nationalism for what it is, domestic terrorism. It is a threat to the United States, and we've seen its devastating toll this weekend, and we need to call out the president himself for advancing racism and white supremacy." Ironically, the Washington Times reports that the Dayton shooter, who killed his sister and 8 others, described himself on social media as a pro-Satan leftist, who wanted Joe Biden's generation to die off, hated Trump, and hoped to vote for Senator Elizabeth Warren for president. "I want socialism, and I'll not wait for the idiots to finally come round to understanding," Connor Betts, the killer, reportedly tweeted, not to be left behind. Senator Kamala Harris, DeKalb, said of the president after the slaughter, "He's a racist, there's no question in my mind. These attacks, unprecedented in their savagery, testify to a hatred of Trump that is broad, deep and implacable, and unlikely to be constrained before November 2020. Folks still speak wistfully of a return to the unity America once knew and of a coming together to stand again on common ground. But where is the evidence for that hope? If Trump's fabled base is going to stand loyally by him, and the Democratic candidates are going to unleash this kind of bile against him, whoever wins in 2020 will not be able to unite us. Clearly the issue in the 2020 campaign will be Trump. Is impeachment now back on the table? How can it not be? Though Robert Mueller found no collusion between the 2016 Trump campaign and the Russians, support for impeachment hearings passed the midway mark inside the Democratic caucus in the House last week, even before the horrible weekend. And if Democrats believe about Trump what their candidates say about him, that he is a white nationalist, racist and xenophobe deliberately stoking fear, hatred, and violence, whose words and actions call to mind the fascist regimes of World War II, how can the Democratic leadership credibly not try to impeach him? Yet, blaming the massacre in El Paso on the rhetoric of Trump is a charge that can come back to bite his attackers. Neither the right nor left has a monopoly on political extremism or violence, and the hate-filled rhetoric of the left this last weekend exceeds anything used by Trump. "Sorry, but job numbers are fake happy news," by Paul Craig Roberts. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, reports that the U.S. economy created 148,000 new private sector jobs during July. The jobs number does not translate into employed people, as increasingly Americans hold 2 or more jobs. For example, the BLS reports that from June to July the number of multiple job holders rose by 233,000, which is 85,000 more than the 148,000 new private sector jobs. "What we are seeing is not more people employed, but more multiple job holders. Since May, the number of multiple job holders has increased by 534,000. The claim of a falling rate of unemployment over the past decade is inconsistent with the falling labor force participation rate. Normally, when employment prospects are good, the labor force participation rate increases. To explain away the inconsistency, economists claim that the decline in the labor force participation rate reflects the increased retirements of the baby boomer generation. However, the BLS reported that the labor force participation rate for older workers of retirement age surged to the highest level in 7 years. So what is really going on? The answer is that retired people, thanks to the Federal Reserve's low to zero interest rate over the last decade, cannot live on their pensions and their savings. They have to take part-time jobs to make ends meet. Younger people, however, cannot form independent households on the basis of part-time jobs, and as they have no pension income to supplement the meager pay of a part-time job, have dropped out of the workforce. The reason the reported unemployment rate is low is that the millions who have dropped out of the labor force because they cannot find life-sustainable employment are not counted as unemployed. What do these people do? They live with parents or grandparents and they work cash jobs, house-sitting, walking dogs, cutting grass, and various relatively low-paying handyman jobs. There are many problems with the payroll jobs report and always are. For example, the July report finds 16,000 new manufacturing jobs, but the manufacturing index weakened for the fourth consecutive month. How do manufacturing jobs rise when manufacturing activity declines? Another anomaly is the collapse of 7 trucking companies this year. If the economy is so good, why has demand declined for transportation to move goods from producers to warehouses and from warehouses to retail outlets? Americans live in a world in which explanations are controlled. The facts are whatever serves the interests of the ruling elites. Identity politics serves to keep Americans disunited. We hear far more about white supremacy and misogyny than we hear about the agendas that control our very existence.